Surveys show that no more than 25% of people consider themselves creative. Today, one of the most important designers of the last half century, the creator of IDEO, perhaps the most prestigious design firm in the world and of the Stanford D School, is here to insist that the correct proportion is 100%. David Kelly on Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. A native of Barberton, Ohio, just outside Akron, David Kelly received his undergraduate degree in electrical engineering from Carnegie Mellon and his master's in design from Stanford. Mr. Kelly was briefly, but only briefly, a doctoral student. In 1980, Mr. Kelly worked with a young, unknown entrepreneur to design a new device for controlling computers. That entrepreneur was Steve Jobs, and the device was the mouse. In 1991, Mr. Kelly founded the design firm IDEO, which now has offices in a dozen cities, including London, Munich, Mumbai, and Tokyo. And in 2005, he led the creation of the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design here at Stanford, known universally simply as the D School. David Kelly holds one other distinction. In all the long history of Stanford University, he is the only person to have been made a tenured professor without a doctorate. With his brother and longtime collaborator, Tom, last year, David Kelly published Creative Confidence, Unleashing the Creative Potential Within Us All. David Kelly, welcome.
Thank you.
Everybody, creative confidence. Let me quote you to yourself. In our experience, everybody is the creative type. Come on, really?
My proof is go to a kindergarten class and ask them how many people are, ask them how many of them are creative. Everybody will enthusiastically raise their hand and show you what they're working on. So we, when we really started the D School, I thought we were going to teach creativity, you know, but it turns out you don't have to. All we really have to do is to remove the blocks that are in the way of that creativity.
Got it. Now, this book, I thought when I began reading it, is a how-to book. In fact, you have much grander designs, which I would like to get to by beginning with the circumstances that led to writing it. In April 2007, your cell phone rang and your doctor's number came up. And what happened?
He said that that I had throat cancer, head and neck cancer, and that that it was, you know, I had a 40% chance of survival and that they would treat me. And that my life was going to change. And it did. I mean, I don't know, people who have had that experience know that, you know, I have a full-time job at IDEO, a full-time professor. And on that moment, my life, just all those meetings that were on my calendar and all those things I thought were really important to do, just stopped. And for the next year, I fought the cancer.
Surgery, chemotherapy, radiation. And you've said that for many months, your main objective in life was to hold down your food.
Yes.
Your brother Tom, what role did he play?
My brother Tom, you know, he's my younger brother and he's been a part of my life in a very kind of lovely way forever. We shared the same room when we were at home as kids. But, it was really nice. He was there for me every day when I had cancer. And just like, you know, he works at IDEO as well. And so it was always nice that I could leave IDEO knowing my brother was there. Mm-hmm. You know, if I was on a business trip, my brother was there. And this was even more meaningful that, you know, that I couldn't do things like, organize my own medication. But I knew my brother was there and I'd worked with him for many years. And so he was a real godsend.
And in this book that you wrote together, quote, we vowed that if David survived, boy, that's rough. Just a few years ago, that was the question. Would you survive?
Yes.
We vowed that if David survived, we would work together side by side on a project that would allow us to share ideas with each other and the world. So that is the project in this book. It's not a how-to book, although it is a how-to book, is how you and your organization can solve problems better, unleash a certain creativity.
Yes.
But you're really, at the most basic level, writing a book about how to live. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we think that if you talk to the psychologists, they would call what I call creative confidence self-efficacy. And it's really I think, the kind of one of the essential ways to have a vital life. And self-efficacy is like this, that you have a sense of the way the world's put together and that you can accomplish what you set out to do in life, right? And so once I understood that I was going to survive, the thing that I really wanted to do was make that my life's work, was to have as many people as possible gain this new kind of living with confidence, and confident that they are a creative person.
All right. And you write not only that everybody can be creative, really you're arguing that everybody should be creative. If you're in a rut, if you're in a slump, if you're just following rules, sit up and do something about it. The world, I'm quoting you here, the world needs more creative policymakers, officer managers, and real estate agents.
Everybody can be wildly creative, in my opinion. Yeah, what happens is, you know, most people, as I said, I believe everybody in kindergarten is creative. But by about age 9 or so, you know, people opt out of thinking themselves as creative. Something happens. You know, a teacher says that's not a very good drawing, or you can't play the piano very well, or whatever it is. You're not a dancer, whatever it is. They've confused kind of talent with creativity. And for some reason, that kind of negative critique really sticks with us, and people opt out of thinking of themselves as creative. And so they go about their life saying that. Mm. And so by the time they get to adulthood, it's pretty ingrained. But the good news is, we really find that if you help somebody and you give them a series of small successes in a creative area, that it comes back, that they actually build that confidence. But you really have to have a kind of immersive experience.
All right. So let's talk about the immersive experience. I want to repeat, you have the D School. It is a unit of Stanford University. Kids go through 10-week courses. You've written a book about this. Right. You have IDEO. There is a much richer body of work available than we're going to be able to get to right now. But I want to plunge in to try to convey some of what the D School does. So why don't you tell us one D School story, the Embrace Infant Warmer.
Sure. So Embrace comes from a class called Extreme Affordability. We have lots and lots of classes at the D School. One nice thing about the D School is everybody kind of opts in. You know, we don't pay the professors. A lot of the students don't give degrees. And so you're there because you want to be there.
So you're taking time out from attending the business school or the school of education or the medical school or the engineering school. You take time out from that curriculum to do a project at the D School.
Correct. And then you go back there and get your degree.
Right.
Okay. So in the case of Embrace is in this class, Extreme Affordability, and the students go to India. They go to places like India or Myanmar or Africa, and they look for needs. They look for things that could really solve problems that are meaningful to people. So the Embrace people are looking in hospitals, and they're looking at incubators, because there's so many young children dying because they can't maintain their body weight. But they go into the hospitals and the incubators are not full. I mean, what's the story? You know, they're going to design a better incubator in their kind of first blush. And what they found was that they had to completely reframe the problem. A lot of innovation comes from not problem solving, but deciding what's worth working on in the first place, reframing the problem and then solving it. And so that's what happened here. And so they found that the babies were dying out in the villages and they couldn't get to the hospital. So
they couldn't keep them alive long enough to get them into a Western incubator.
Exactly.
Okay.
So what they decided to do was brilliant, was to make this thing that had paraffin wax in it that they could heat up. And then it would keep the kind of, you know, the right 98.6 kind of temperature going long enough for the baby to start eating and start gaining body weight. And so it's just been a huge success. I mean, hundreds of thousands of lives will be saved. It's from this kind of, we look at it as our process that we call design thinking, where you go out into the world and you build empathy, right, for the people that you're trying to help. Whether it could be, you know, Wall Street, you know, executives, or it can be, you know, people in the bush in Africa. But But by understanding that, then you can, we call it need finding, you can find a problem that's worth working on. And that's what happened in Embrace.
And so Embrace is now the company that grew out of this.
Yes.
And the product is, and it was extreme affordability. So what does one of these sort of backpacks with heatable paraffin wax cost?
It's a $200 sleeping bag.
So there are sponsors who help to subsidize this.
Yeah, or not, depending. You know, we find that in a lot of these developing world kind of things, we want to be able to really make them sustain and charge full price. We want them to be made in the country.
There's a self-sustaining company built on it.
Yeah, so yeah. Embrace is a self-sustaining company. We've had lots of them in that class and other classes, but we're in Silicon Valley. The students are able and excited about starting their own companies, and so that's not our role. Our role is not the entrepreneurship part. We're just trying to find really interesting problems that will get the students excited so they'll work on this, on building their confidence. So we'll have lots of projects. If you come to D-School, even in a 10-week class, you'll do lots of projects.
Right. So a little more on design thinking. Here in Creative Confidence, you write that one of the breakthrough, one of the eureka light bulb moment for you, you who spend your life having light bulb moments, a light bulb moment was that IDEO was not selling designs. What you really had done was develop a methodology,
yes,
which you now call design thinking.
Right.
And I would also note that although IDEO is a great big successful, there is money gushing into that company with 500 employees, offices around the world, you're an evangelist about this design thinking. People may buy this book, students may go to the D-School, but there's also, I just discovered looking at the D-School website last night, there's a free 90-second course in design thinking. Free! Anybody in the world may take it. 90-minute course.
Yeah. Crash.
Crash course in design thinking on the D-School website. Just briefly, because this is television, not a book, I'd just like to ask you, I'm just going to name each of the steps, the five steps that you name in design thinking, and you tell me what they mean.
Okay.
Empathize.
Empathize means just what we were talking about in Embrace. Instead of sitting in your office and using your big brain to try to come up with ideas about what you want to come up with for your next invention or for your next involvement, wherever it is, we call this thing bias towards action. Go out into the world and be with people. You know, so I gave my students my present students their project, and it's improved the experience of taking the train from Palo Alto to San Francisco. So the empathize phase would be ride the train, talk to the conductor, watch people buy tickets, go into people's homes and see how they decide which train to take, you know, look at the signs and how do you get out of the train in San Francisco, but just be in the middle of it and be, you know, open-minded to watching people and see what they do, where they have troubles, and what they care about.
Get out of yourself.
Yeah, we'd have way too much meetings with people sitting around a table talking about things rather than being immersed in the situation so that you can figure out what's going on.
Step two, define.
Define. So I would say that one of the things that's most unique about design thinking is that the process of defining what the problem is inside of our process. Most processes that I know about for innovation have the problem statement comes here.
Comes first.
Comes right. First, and then you try to innovate to make something exciting given that problem statement. We try to put the definition stage in the middle of the process. So every time you're going around, you're iterating it in the process, you ask yourself, is there a more interesting project I could be working on here? Meaning redefine. So we redefine the problem as the natural part rather than accepting it.
So that when the kids get to Bhutan, thinking that they don't have enough incubators, they get to the hospital and discover the incubators they have aren't even being used.
Yes.
They redefine the problem as keeping the kids alive between the village and the hospital.
Exactly. So in that same class, in extreme affordability, we sent them out to look at the problems of water in India, and some of the students found out that kerosene was a bigger problem in their minds. You know, the kerosene that they burn at night.
Right.
And so they did a project that ended up being a solar lantern called Delight. So they were given water, and they ended up coming up with a solar lantern that solved the kerosene problem. Or we have another class called Liberation Technologies where they go to Africa and they're looking at fire prevention. Mm-hmm. And when they go into the villages and talk to people, people are not so worried about the fires, though they are. But the reason they're worried about the fires is they're worried about their documents. Their documents are really important and they're really vulnerable in their minds. So the students start a class, start a company, that takes computers around and scans everybody's documents and puts them up in the cloud. So the way to look at that is another group might have said, you told me to look at fire prevention, so I'm just going to look at fire prevention, even though I discovered this other thing that's actually a more interesting problem called document protection.
Right.
And so our process allows you to redefine the problem so that you're working on something more meaningful for the people that you've discovered in the empathy phase.
Right. Okay. Step 3 of 5, ideate.
Ideate. Okay. So now, after you've defined the problem and you have a point of view about what you want to do, point of view is really you have a user group and you have some inspiration. What you need to do is to in a cyclical way, come up with ideas, right? Somebody said, if you want a good idea, have lots of ideas. And so,
You're presuming the team would be at the D
school. This is all team. This whole thing is a team sport. I'm not talking about individuals at all. So the team is now going to, in combination with talking to what we call extreme users and people down the middle and stuff, and all the experts they can find, and looking at the state of the art and what else is out there in this new thing that you've just found out, is to come up with as many ideas as you can. It's like the brainstorming phase, right? As many ideas as you can, we group them together. The idea is to really have what we call fluency and flexibility. Lots and lots of ideas just for the sake of lots of ideas, and ideas that are different one from the next, flexible compared to the next one. So now you have this big mass. In our process, there's a converging and diverging back and forth. So this is the diverging, that's a diverging phase. Come up with as many as you can, and the next phase we're going to select.
Okay, and the next phase you call prototype.
Prototype. So we really find, you know, how they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. We think a prototype is worth like 1,000,000 words. So if I tell you about my new idea for this new coffee cup, you might not be that interested, right? But if I actually build one with my new, you know, digital warmed whatever coffee cup, and I actually have you try it out, now you're going to help me. You're going to tell me what's wrong with it. Humans are really good at telling you what's wrong with other people's ideas. And so we find that prototype, I define a prototype as painting a picture of the future with your idea in it. So this is a physical thing, but if I wanted to prototype the experience of checking into Stanford Hospital, I can prototype that. You know, I can, with cardboard, build a space, or I can find a place at Stanford, and I can hire actors, and I can pretend, and I can bring in a bunch of public, and I can prototype that and see what happens. We looked at IDEO, we looked at, for Walgreens, we looked at their stores, and one of the things that was clear was that the pharmacist is up in this big glass thing looking down on you, you know, and we wanted to try what it would be like to have the pharmacist down on the kind of level of everybody else across the counter or a table. And so the way we did that was we got a warehouse and we started with cardboard. We started building those things out. Now you could have everybody. Users, the president of the company, the pharmacist, to see if they were going to be willing to make this new move. And so that physicality of the prototype, that painting the picture of the future so that you can see it. I mean, most of my students, you know, they used to, they'd kind of bring it. We used to design just objects mostly, and they'd bring it in and we'd put a black cloth under it and we'd pull it up. But now with my students, everybody makes, if you're trying to prototype what the experience of your idea is, we find videos the way to go. So we'll sit down and every team of students has to make like a 3-minute video. So presentation day, instead of a bunch of hardware and a bunch of like black cloths being pulled up, is now, you know, we pop popcorn, we load the 3-minute videos, and we all sit there and play them, and then we can critique them one at a time, the whole class. But it's this, prototyping is really this iterative way of painting a picture of the future.
Which leads to the final step, testing.
testing. So it's not enough to build this prototype and think you did that it's okay, right? What you really have to do is bring the people it's going to matter. If we're building a new nurses station, we have to bring real nurses in and test it. And they'll have all kinds of good ideas about how to improve it. And then we go back and we cycle through. This whole thing is really a cycle all the way through.
Also, you haven't touched on that. I guess my job to bring it out, I guess. It's fast.
Yes.
At the D school, you require all, if I understand this correctly, you require all the teams to go through all five steps, including that prototyping and testing, within 10 weeks, within the space of the course.
Several times within 10 weeks.
Several times within 10
so
weeks.
So our fastest story is a really interesting one. So we have a class at the D School called Launchpad. In the Launchpad, you have to have your product in the world in the fifth week. You actually, it has to be real in the fifth week. So it's a little bit funny because you already come in with your idea. Most classes, you come up with the idea, but this is one where you come to the teaching team and you say, I have this idea, and if they like it, they'll let it go. But there's a company now in the world called Pulse, and Pulse started in Launchpad, and these—
It's a news—
News aggregator.
News aggregator, isn't it? Right. Well, I'm familiar.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and so they spent the weeks like in a coffee shop in Palo Alto. I don't think they're allowed to go in there anymore, but they were in there all the time, and they were just prototyping their news aggregator and showing it to people on the iPad and getting and changing it and moving it around. Week five, they launched. They got sued by the New York Times when they launched.
And, a very good result.
Yeah, they got offers from the San Jose Mercury News as employees. Same week, it was a big week for them, and then they got it out in the world. It became the best best-selling iPad app in the world. They sold to LinkedIn for $90 million.
Wow.
These two guys.
Wow.
But the point of that was the speed.
So David,
so 5 weeks then.
You mean if I sign up 5 weeks from now, I'll be worth $90 million?
Well, we can't guarantee that, no. No, that's not the goal. I mean, our goal is to make innovators. You know, whether they're successful in that way or not, it's up to them. But, I mean, we're really trying to make people, you know, able to kind of routinely come up with big ideas. Sounds a little lofty, but we really believe it happens.
The boy from Ohio, how did an ordinary middle-class kid from the outskirts of Akron end up in the white-hot center of Silicon Valley? To begin with, you graduated from Carnegie Mellon in electrical engineering. David, I may be wrong, but double E is not the place you'd start a career in creativity, I don't think.
No, it's not. I was building my analytical excellence, not my creative excellence. I mean, that's the way I say it, or I was wasting my time, depending. What happened to me was, which I hope happens to everybody, is that you know, I was in the wrong place and I was wandering around, but I was constantly looking and my friends were constantly telling me what I, you know, that you should go do this or you should go this. And I just paid attention. And 1973, it was in the gas crisis.
Right.
And I was in a carpool. I mean, I put up a sign and the guy, a sign is, did anybody want to be in a carpool together to save money?
Right.
And he did. Anyways, and he was from Stanford. I didn't know where Stanford was. I thought Stanford was in Los Angeles. But anyways, he said, as he got to know me, he said, man, you're a designer. You got to go to this program at Stanford. It's so good. And I said, I can't get in. I got terrible grades. And anyways, what I found was that, and it's, I think it's true today, is that if you find your fit, you'll get in. You know what I mean? It's like I was so clearly, even though my grades weren't so good, I was so clearly a fit for this program that my mentor, Bob McKim, who ran the program, then let me in.
Famous figure.
And so once I got to Stanford and found this design stuff, you know, it's like it just fit. And so, I've just continued to enjoy it and build on it.
Was design as taught at this university in the 1970s as create? Did it have the emphasis on creativity that
it
you
did?
Did it really?
It did.
Did it really?
Yeah. It started in 1958 by a guy named John Arnold, and it was wildly creative. It just wasn't valued by society very much yet, but I mean, it was, I mean, need finding and a lot of the basic premises of what we do now was absolutely there when I was a student in the 70s.
Wow. So 1978, you started your own firm, which would, through various iterations, become IDEO. And in 1980, Steve Jobs comes calling. Did you learn from him?
Oh, wow. Yeah, you could talk. I mean, he introduced me to my wife, so I learned a few things from that way. But the main thing I learned from him was to do everything to the hilt. He was the world's best client. He was difficult. But as far as what I got from him, I got the notion that to do everything to the hilt. You know, you can do the smallest, and you see it in their products, right? You can do the smallest thing and do it in an extreme way. And so whether it was, you know, the way you sent an email or the way you folded the letter or the way you made the circuits line out inside of the product. I mean, he would call me in the middle. We were both bachelors at the time. He would call me in the middle at 3 a.m, we were hanging together, so he wouldn't even say it's Steve. He'd just start talking. You know, the phone would ring. I knew it was him. Nobody else calls at 3 a.m. And he'd say, you know, and this is true. Right. He said, you know those screws on the inside? This is next we're doing now. Right. He said, you know those screws on the inside? You know, they're CAD plated. You know, I think they should be nickel plated. I said, Steve, they're on the inside. This is 3 a.m. I said, Steve, they're on the inside, right? And he said, yeah, but you know, I think then he just hang up. I mean, you know, but he cared. I mean, this is the CEO of the company talking about screws on the inside of a product. He's something. I have to say, as difficult as he was really sweet to me. When we were talking about my cancer, in 2007, the iPhone came out.
Right.
And I'm in bed. I'm sick, and you know, Steve comes to the house a bit, and he came over, and he brought with me the first day he brought an iPhone. It was the first day they came out. It was so sweet. The funny part of the story is that he's sitting there, and I'm pretty much comatose, I guess. I don't know, but he's plenty antsy, and so he decides he's going to hook the phone up. He's going to call AT&T and get my phone hooked up. It's the first day, right? And my phone's going to be live. Anyway, there's a phone right by my bed, and he's there on the phone talking to the guy at AT&T. And he's screaming. I can hear him screaming at the guy at AT&T. It's not working, right? And so he hangs up, and I said, I heard him say stuff like, look, I'm Steve Jobs, you know, that kind of stuff. And he hangs up, and I said, what did he say? And Steve said he was Napoleon.
David, the role of money. Before founding the D School at this not-for-profit institution known as Stanford University, you built a big firm. IDEO is a big, successful firm. Steve Jobs, in the world of business, he may have been an artist. It's always struck me that of all the entrepreneurs produced in the 80s and 90s, he was the one to whom beauty mattered.
Mm-hmm.
Profits mattered to Steve, too.
Sure.
And so the typical academic view of commerce might be something along the lines of it's coarsening for society, it dulls our finer instincts, and yet here you are, you live your life in commerce, you develop the importance of creativity in commerce. At the D School, you just mentioned that many of these, some of them, the extreme affordability, there's a strong social component, but a lot of these kids want to build companies
they
that
do.
Are profitable.
They do. Mm-hmm.
So how do you, are you three cheers for capitalism? Is commerce the place that elicits the greatest creativity?
I think commerce is the place where the kind of cutting edge interest in a lot of things comes from. And so that makes me interested. IDEO's way at the cutting edge of things because money's changing hands and it's a driver, right? I really think that what I really care about is new ideas, innovation, you know, driving economies or driving interest or whatever it is. And so I really think there's really three components of that, and that would be technology, business, and human values. And so I'm kind of equally interested in all of them. You know, like if you come up with a new technology, you still have to make sure that there's a way to deliver it viable from a business point of view, and people have to actually resonate with it. And it's the same way the other way around. If you have a business idea, you have to take the risk that people will. So one of the things that we do a lot of though is come in from the, which is missing. I think the thing we contribute is looking at things from a human point of view, human factors point of view, and try to figure out, you know, what people really value, and then we'll take the risk that we'll come up with the technology that solves that problem, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at those three, you know, business, technology, and human values all coming together, that's what I think. So I'm really interested in commerce because it's one of those three things that that you can't be successful without all those three things happening.
So, but what you would say, if one of your kids at the D school sits down and begins with the following question, how do I make a lot of money? You would immediately say wrong question.
Yeah, absolutely. No, wrong question. I mean, not wrong question because I care that, you know, about the, his value systems. Wrong question because you don't get there from there. You have to have concern. I mean, the concern for people and the concern for
empathy comes first.
Yeah, empathy comes first. I mean, that's just my point of view. I mean, I'm sure there's other ways to get there, right?
Well, your point of view is powerful enough to have produced a best-selling book. So we'll pay attention to your point of view, David. Listen, one question about the D school. I've always wanted to ask this, and in front of cameras is as good a place as any. The D school's work product is not books. It's not learned articles. It isn't basic research into medicine or science or archaeology. It doesn't fit with a great university. And yet just under a decade ago, you talked Stanford into letting you build it. How did you pull that off?
We have, I would say it's like, it was like a perfect storm. You know, it was lucky. We had a fantastic dean, a very open-minded dean, a man named Jim Plummer, who's just stepped down. We have a new dean. He was in a double E. He was an electrical engineer, and he taught in the electrical engineering department. But when we proposed to him the notion that this was going to apply to all students, that all students could unlock that creativity, his students who were double E's, everybody, it just resonated with him. He came to some of the design classes. We were teaching design since 1958. So he came to some of those design classes and saw that there were other things besides the technical aspects of engineering that were interesting. And so between him and the provost and the president, that was the perfect storm. Those three, I'm not sure they understood exactly what we were talking about, because how could they? You know, this was all new stuff, but they were definitely open-minded enough to look at it.
They took a flyer on you and you delivered, and it worked out.
Yeah, well, and this man, Hassel Plattner, who was an IDEO client, and I talking to him about it, and he thought it was a good idea, and so he was the donor. And so the combination of open-mindedness and having the money made it go.
Great. A couple of last questions, if I may, David. We hear a lot about the hollowing out of American manufacturing, jobs going overseas. Your boyhood town of Akron is not what it used to be.
Gone.
For that matter, when you came here to Stanford in the 1970s, there were still a lot of fab plants around.
There were, for sure.
There was manufacturing wafers going on, and that's gone. Last I heard, T.J. Rogers had the last fab plant, and that closed up a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Your friend Steve Jobs, today when you buy an iPhone, the packaging says not made in California, it says designed in California.
Yes.
Okay. And yet, you've been talking about the D school. You've been talking about the technique or methodology of design thinking, and it is wildly popular. Does this say anything about the future of Silicon Valley, or even about the future of the American economy, that design thinking is somehow, is it going to change the shape of the economy? This is the big thing stuff that I know you don't particularly like, but I thought I'd give it a try.
No, anyway. I think I'm not presumptuous enough to think that, you know, that our little thing that we're doing will, but I do think that the U.S. is particularly well suited for being innovative. I mean, when we grew up, everybody knew who invented the cotton gin and who invented the telephone and stuff. That was our heroes. They were our heroes. You know, in Europe, they might have taught you who painted what. They didn't teach us that. They taught us who. And so I think our heroes, you know, well, you know, Thomas Edison, if you really look at it, those kind of people are our heroes. And I think that'll continue to drive us in that direction of that, you know, innovation is something that we're good at and that will drive the economy. Now, with respect to manufacturing, I'm a firm believer that, you know, that manufacturing will come back when it's appropriate in different places. So we're trying to be wildly creative about how we do everything, and manufacturing is just one aspect of that. So there's plenty of examples where it made sense, you know, to build the Tesla or Heath Ceramics or, you know, it just whatever we're trying to do what is the most. Everything is just a constraint, and how you manufacture something is just one of the constraints that you can innovate on. And so I'm totally with it if you want to manufacture in a foreign country, if that's the right thing to do. And we have, you know, and you know, I think Detroit will come back, you know, for instance, when we've used our cleverness to find out how manufacturing in the U.S. Is a strategically good idea. And so you just have to let that happen, you know.
Okay. David Kelly and the structure of reality. A little more big thing here for you, David. I'm going to give it a try. In creative confidence, you insist that we're all creative, that we and not this is not just how to get rich. We've already discussed about this. This is at some pretty basic level, this is how to do well in business, commerce, but it's also how to lead a full life.
Yeah, how to enjoy your life.
So we find fulfillment by working with our minds and our hands, solving problems. Throughout the book, you convey a sense of meantness. We are meant to behave this way. This is the way reality is structured. And one specific example just struck me right from the introduction. When you were stricken with cancer, you and your brother Tom wrote, quote, a recurring question was, what was I put on earth to do? Close quote. Put on earth by whom?
I don't know. Because nobody knows the answer to that, right?
So yeah, but I'm so struck that you considered an organizing question at the moment when you are examining your life most intensely. You say, why am I here?
Well, I don't know. I don't consider myself religious in any way, but when you're facing, you know, cancer and death, I mean, you start making deals with whatever higher powers there are in the world. So I believe that there is some kind of, you know, force that that makes things happen. You know, I don't know that it has anything to do with religion, but it's some cosmic sense. So you feel very, when you're facing a terminal disease, you feel very alone. And so the notion that, you know, that you were put on earth is a really satisfying one, right? So what I'm really interested in is fit. So the real answer to that question for me is about fit. So all my students, I have, you know, 50 academic advisees and graduate students and all the students in my classes. And what I hope for them is that they can find that fit in life. Because if you find out what you're put on earth to do, if you can keep looking for that, I mean, I really think that it's all easy after that. I mean, it's all, you know, it's like, you know, that whole thing about a job, you know, you'll never work a day of your life if you're fit. But I feel really bad. I have some large percentage of the people that I know that I would describe as have a job that looks good but feels bad. Mm. I mean, they're doctors and lawyers and business people and stuff where their job looks good, you know, to the rest of the world. They're going on lovely vacations and stuff, and it looks good, but it doesn't feel good. You know, I mean, if you really get to them, you know, they say, oh, I really like to write a novel. You know, I'm really much more creative than this. And that's kind of what I'm working on.
That's sad.
It's sad, yeah. That's what I want to work on is helping people find their fit so they have jobs that look good and feel good.
Truly the last question. IDEO, the D School, a stream of products from the mouse on and on and on to the methodology of design thinking itself. What's your proudest accomplishment?
My proudest accomplishment in business is building a stage and letting all these other, my students and employees and everything, perform on it. It was hard. It was the reason it's my most proudest day was it was the hardest to do, because when you're a performer, when you're the designer and everybody's looking at you, you know, like you're a designer, for you to say, I'm not going to design anymore because I'm going to build the stage and let others perform on it, it was very hard. I think that's, I'm really proud of the fact that so many people are empowered by these organizations and they find their fit, you know, and so they basically enjoy their life.
David Kelly, author of Creative Confidence, thank you. For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.